Good morning, or afternoon, or evening, whenever you happen to be listening to this. Medical Education's podcast listeners, this is Kevin Eva again, the editor of the journal, coming to you from a far too stereotypical Vancouver morning. It's November, and it's our rainiest season, so everybody's bracing themselves, trying to stay dry. I can do that today with a bit of excitement as I look forward to the release of the January issue. As many of you will know, it's our third in the line of the State of the Science issues that we've started publishing with august authors from around the field sharing their views on where they stand with a particular area of research. And today I have the distinct pleasure of chatting with Jim Crossley, one of those authors who's a clinical pediatrician with a post at the University of Sheffield in the academic unit of medical education there. And Jim, along with Brian Jolly, have submitted a paper entitled Ask the Right People, the Right Questions About the Right Things in the Right Way for that special issue. And thanks, Jim, for taking the time to chat with me today.
Thank you, Kevin.
I know you're right in the midst of renovating a new house, so I'm particularly glad that you found the time away from your hammer, but I'll try not to keep it too long. One of the things I feel almost obligated to start with is I've noticed over your publication record that you always provide very witty and clever titles, and this one's no exception. I wonder if you could use the title to explain for our listeners what your paper's about.
Oh, thank you for that, Johnson. I'm also grateful for your opinion about the titles. I think Brian and I chose a title which we hoped would make simple a synthesis and analysis which is a bit disparate and in some ways complicated. And we chose that because we think that the fundamental message of our paper is a synthesizing message. In many respects, what we aimed to communicate to the readership is a very unsurprising conclusion. We're writing about assessment that takes place in the workplace, which has been a huge area of development in my experience in the United Kingdom, and I think from my reading also around most of the developed world. And for good theoretical reasons. What's very interesting is that, in our opinion, the design of the instruments being used for assessment in the workplace owes more to a history of formalized, structured assessment than it does to any serious consideration about assessment that takes place in the workplace. In other words, we felt that the instruments were, broadly speaking, very unfit design for the setting and the assessors that would be using them. And I hope that the title communicates some of that idea.
And I know this is following up and it's really an expansion of thought and presentation of some of the empirical evidence that you've collected around improving the utility of these sorts of assessment instruments. What's the root of the problem that you saw that you've tried to address with this work?
Yes, thank you. It is an expansion. And I'd want to say that this is a paper which is aimed to be synthesizing and stretching and somewhat speculative, and we do say that in the text. Perhaps one strand of the paper is quite well evidenced, and other strands are, at this stage, I think, ripe areas for investigation, and we wanted to share them with the research community generally. And so you asked about the route in. Because most of my working week is as a clinician, I find that most of my engagement with research is occasionally a designer, but much more often an analyst of instruments that other people have developed. In one respect, that is a disappointing position, but in another respect, it's actually a very exciting position because I can observe features of assessment data from a very wide range of settings. And when I'm not crunching the numbers, I can reflect gently on why I notice certain outcomes in the data. And one such example comes from an analysis that I was conducting as part of a UK team, looking at instruments that were designed to assess trainee surgeons. And many people can relate to the fact that of all the jobs in medicine, a surgeon's job is about being able to do the task. Most of us would rather have an operation done by a surgeon who's good at his operating than by a surgeon who's poor at his operating but makes up for it in other areas. And so, quite rightly, the institutions that were developing these instruments were asking the trainers of trainee surgeons to judge their surgical performance. And there were three workplace-based assessment instruments under examination in this evaluation study. And as I worked through the data, broadly speaking, they performed as workplace-based assessments do perform, somewhat disappointingly, with most assessors being undiscriminatingly positive about the trainees, with a very few exceptions. Mm-hmm. And psychometrically, that works out as quite undiscriminating or unreliable assessment results. And then I got to the third instrument and a particular scale on this third instrument, and I did the psychometrics, and I was really amazed to discover that surgeons using this particular scale were able to discriminate between trainees hugely consistently across operating procedures and across different assessors. Broadly speaking, they agreed about which trainees could do the task well and which could not. And it stood out as a very highly reliable method. And I looked carefully at the scale and reflected on why it might work so well. And I'll perhaps share the scale with you because it gets us a foothold on the idea.
Great.
The scale asks the surgeons to judge the trainee on a four-point judgment. The least able trainees are those who are, in the words of the scale, unable to perform the procedure or part of it, even under supervision. The more able trainees are able to perform the procedure or part of it under supervision. The next level is able to perform the procedure with minimum supervision, and the top level is competent to perform the procedure unsupervised. Now, there's nothing very dramatic about that scale, but as I describe the anchor points, perhaps you notice that these are judgments that surgeons are extremely used to making. If you were to listen to a conversation between a couple of trainer surgeons about their trainees, this would be the language they would use. Is this a trainee that I trust to do operations in my presence, with my availability, or completely independently? And it struck me that this excellent alignment between the language of the assessment instrument and the cognitive framework or reality map of the surgeons who are being asked to make judgments may well be the reason for the superior performance of the instrument. So the right thing seemed to be to test that hypothesis, and I had the privilege of working with a different surgical college, the College of Physicians in the UK, that oversees the training of physicians throughout the UK. They were developing assessment instruments for, if you like, the mirror purposes amongst physicians that these instruments were for amongst surgeons. And they were open to the idea that we evaluate in parallel the typical rating scales that are used on workplace-based assessment instruments. And we could perhaps talk a bit more about that in a moment. To parallel those with scales that, like the one I've described, are deliberately carefully aligned to the way in which supervisors think about their trainees. Identifying the core ingredient of that, of course, is the art. And after some thinking, we decided that at least a core ingredient should be the capacity for independent practice, which I think is the core ingredient in the surgical scale. But I'd like to say that in my view, it's not automatically the case that the capacity for independence would be the right core ingredient of every scale. I think there needs to be some careful thought about what cognitive frameworks assessors naturally use when evaluating trainees. We implemented an evaluation which utilized both a traditional assessment scale and an innovative assessment scale. Mm-hmm. On three previously well-known instruments on a very large number of UK trainees to test our hypothesis. And to my complete delight, the innovative scales dramatically outperformed the traditional scales. When I say outperformed, what I mean from a psychometric point of view is that assessors agreed with each other about which trainees were strong and which were weak, and separated those trainees more consistently and more widely from one another when using the traditional scale.
You introduced this notion by saying that the idea wasn't very dramatic But in fact, part of the reason that I was so enthralled by your presentation when I first heard you mention these results was that it does fly counter to much of the common advice that we get in the field about scale tweaking. Yes. and how that doesn't tend to have much influence.
Yes. May I infer your question and then go to answer it?
Please.
I'm familiar with that evidence, and in fact, at a much earlier stage in my investigations in this area, had a look at this question of scale design, because it seems obvious that it might be of some importance. I think what's different about the work we've done from the work that I've read is that we're dealing with quite different differences. So comparisons between scales of one design and another have tended to focus on quite narrow questions. For example, using an ordinal numeric scale, does the length of the scale or the visual layout of the scale make any difference to, I'll use the term reliability as a shorthand for the discriminating mm-hmm. and agreeing characteristics we've already described,
right.
Or how do numeric scales, for example, compare with non-numeric scales with anchor descriptors? And the answer, as you've already said, is frequently it doesn't make a lot of difference what you do. What's different here is that we are talking about wholesale non-numeric or descriptor scales. And when you survey existing non-numeric scales, as I did in developing this idea, you discover very quickly that they fall into two main categories. There are those that I think owe their origins to the concept of linearity or parametrics, which choose language which is deliberately open as an expression of the degree of merit. I think the most famous of those scales, which owes its origin, I think, to another Miller, is a 9-point scale, just as an example, mm-hmm. whereby the three lowest points are levels within the category unsatisfactory, the three middle points are levels within the category satisfactory, and the three upper points are levels within the category superior. What underpins that scale is the idea that it should be as ordinal as possible, with a progressive and equal gradations between the points. And it's understandable where that concept will have come from. And many scales fall into a similar flavour, mm-hmm. Family to that scale.
Right.
Other scales that have been influential in the UK, and I think to a lesser extent elsewhere, are scales which begin to try to be objective, but do so by anchoring at expected levels of performance through stages of training. So, for example, the huge foundation program through which all doctors pass in the UK broadly uses scales which ask a respondent whether a trainee has reached the expected level at various points through and perhaps beyond their progression through the foundation program. So these are what you might call training expectation anchored scales. What's different about the scale I've described is that it moves right away from those two ideas, and its whole focus is to try to speak the language that the assessor naturally thinks. You'll notice that the first type of scale I described, the unsatisfactory to superior scale, owes its origin to attempts at being ordinal. The second type of scale owes its origin at attempts to be perhaps objective or defensible from a training decision point of view. But the third one is very different in that it owes its design to trying to speak the language of the assessor. And I think it's that difference that has made, if you like, been the magic in terms of making a difference to assessor outcomes. This is one area where it seems to me in retrospect so tremendously obvious that it makes an awful lot of our previous attempts at workplace assessment design seem somewhat foolish.
You're doing a much better job of eloquently expressing the questions I was about to ask, so keep inferring away. It does seem straightforward in hindsight, but it is a unique and I think very valuable insight to have noticed the importance of deliberately aligning these scales with the way that the raters are already thinking. In the paper that you have coming up in January 2012, as I alluded to earlier, you've broadened the focus a bit, and there were four general principles that I would just note for our readers that you mentioned in that paper. One is to ask assessors who are well-placed to judge the performance. Two is to ask for judgments rather than objective observations. Three is to focus on competencies that are central to the activity observed. And the fourth is what we've just been talking about, aligning the response scale to the reality map of the judges. I'm going to leave it to the reader to take the opportunity to explore all four, but maybe I could just get you to elaborate a bit more on one more of the principles, which I think, again, strikes the field somewhat contradictorily relative to where it had been in the past, which is the second point about asking for judgments rather than objective observations, with so much effort having been put towards being objective for the sake of being defensible. What put you in the position that you want to actually turn that coin on its side, so to speak?
Well, this, I have to say, is not an observation which has been made first by me, but may have been somewhat reinterpreted by me. And it owes its origin to what I think is one of the most interesting counterintuitive findings in all of psychometrics in recent times, which is the work done by, I may well be saying his name wrongly because I've never met him, but Glenn Regier, is that the right way to say Glenn's name?
Yes. Regier, yeah.
So I got close.
That's, yeah, absolutely.
Were you colleagues at one stage, Kevin?
For the first time, we're now working at the same institution. We're both at UBC as of about 18 months ago.
Well, Glenn made an observation, and I think I'm reading the history of this correctly, which was probably a chance observation. At around the time when we were all busy developing a standard-setting approach that wasn't based on content for OSCE examinations, it was commonplace to accompany the objective structured checklist with a very open-ended global scale, which asked simply whether the candidate was below, at or above the level required to pass the exam. And the reason for that scale, as I've already said, was not as an interface for an assessment judgment, but was in order to derive a borderline level of performance. Probably I don't need to go into it now, but essentially the pass mark was an aggregation of a score that a borderline candidate would have got at every station. And Glenn and his team, I don't know if they were alone in this, but and they decided it might be a good idea to look at the reliability of that borderline judgment. And they actually compared it to the reliability of the scores that are derived by adding together the objective elements of the checklist. So here you have a comparison between something that has been deliberately and carefully designed for no disagreement, an objective score list, and something which has not been designed with that in mind at all and is openly and clearly subjective judgment. And the really surprising observation that they made was that examiners agreed, again, they were more reliable. They agreed with each other in discriminating between candidates better on the subjective scale than they did on the objective scale. And this has generally been described as the superiority of global ratings. But I think it's the superiority of experienced subjective judgment rather than the superiority of global ratings. Because you have to think carefully, what is it that examiners are seeing that enables them to agree with each other about how to rank candidates in a way that cannot be expressed on the objective checklist? There must be an ingredient that can't easily be expressed on the checklist that examiners not only can rate, but can consistently agree with each other about. And when I first read that observation, I sat reflecting for some time. At the time, I was developing a consultation assessment instrument, and I was busy reading the literature on consultation. And I was struck by how, I think to use a technical term, how futile, to use a non-technical term, how shallow some of the articulations of a good consultation were. And to quote a few examples from the UK, there were elements that included judgments about whether the consultor shook hands, whether the consultor made sustained eye contact, whether the consultor drew the curtain whilst the patient undressed. And it struck me, even without any psychometric underpinning, that a good consultation is very much more than the sum of those parts. To just take an obvious example, in some settings, shaking hands would be entirely appropriate. And in other settings, it would be, I think, interpreted as dominating, falling into role stereotypes, and potentially unwelcome. Similarly, eye contact in some very obvious ethnic interactions would be entirely inappropriate. So I began to suspect that the reason that this subjective judgment outweighed the sum of its parts is that it's able to take account of context, of weighting, of the interaction between all of the components that go on in a complex issue like a consultation or clinical encounter. So it's always been a matter of interest to me where an instrument contains both, I use this term in the paper, a process level objective observation and a scale that allows for judgment and integration and weighting, which one outperforms the other. And in almost every evaluation that I've ever performed, it has been the case that the unanchored, relatively freehand, gestalt, judgment-orientated assessment outperforms the broken-down, objectified one. So I think this is not just about global scales against smaller checklists. I think this is about allowing for expert judgment where that's appropriate.
Right.
And it's that idea which we expand on and articulate in the paper.
Yeah, and I think that provides a really nice analog for the paper as well, as there is clearly a lot of expert judgment involved in putting the paper together. You alluded earlier to the issue that some of the ideas put forward are speculative at this point, and I think that really nicely reflects the spirit of the state of the science issue, where you've been able to tie together those historical findings with some of the current work you're doing and really push the field off in some interesting directions. So I look forward to seeing the reaction that the paper gets, and thank you again for submitting it to the special issue.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'll just, by way of closing, remind the people who've been listening that I've been speaking with Jim Crossley from Sheffield in the UK, and the paper that we've been discussing is entitled Ask the Right People the Right Questions About the Right Things in the Right Way, and it'll be published in the January 2012 issue of Medical Education. I should perhaps also note that some of the foundational data that Jim described that this paper reflects a broader expansion of was published in, I believe, the June 2011 issue of the journal. So if anybody wants to look in more detail at that work, then that shouldn't be too hard to find either. Thank you once again, Jim, and look forward to the next time we get to chat.
Thanks, Kevin.